a drink. Wink, you wink and think you think. Drunk, you drunk and bunk, you bunk. Funk, you funk and drunk, you drunk. But when you're drunk, don't drive. Having a party tonight. It's gonna last all night. Shotgun will be there. Pop gun. Jazz gun will be there. Drink your drink, drink your drink. Wink your wink and think you think. Drink your drink and drunk your drunk. I say, funk your funk, funk your funk your funk. Funk your funk and drunk your drunk. Bank managers will be there. Bank managers will be there. World Bank, Global Bank, International Bankers will be there. Drink your drink, wink your wink. Think you think, and link your link. Drunk your junk, but if you're drunk, don't drive. That will save your life. Repentance, just party. It will be a shotgun party, a popgun party all night. All right, ganja will be there. Light your spliff, jump in the air. Smoke your skunk, smoke your skunk. Smoke your weed. Smoke your giant. Skeleton from outer space with his Remington in his suitcase. Drink your drink and think your think. Drunk your drunk and funk your funk. Shotgun party, a popgun party. When you get drunk, don't you try. If you wish to stay alive, having a party tonight. Having a party all night. Having a party tonight. It gonna last until the broad light. Jesus. Negus.
Hi, everybody. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Audible Sounds. That was the late, great Lee Scratch Perry with Having a Party. And before that, we had The Spirit of Man off of the album Jeff Wayne's musical version of The War of the Worlds. Before we go, just a reminder that you can catch the show every Thursday at 4 p.m. right here at 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh. We're going to go out with a local artist. Here's Sophistication by Frankie Mitchell.
We'll be right back. Today, we pay tribute to the victims of the transatlantic slave trade. The evil enterprise of enslavement lasted for over 400 years. Millions of African children, women, and men were trafficked across the Atlantic, ripped from their families and homelands, their communities torn apart, their bodies commodified, their humanity denied. The history of slavery is a history of suffering and barbarity that shows humanity at its worst. But it's also a history of awe-inspiring courage that shows human beings at their best, starting with enslaved people who rose up against impossible odds and extending to the abolitionists who spoke out against this atrocious crime. And yet, the legacy of the transatlantic slave trade haunts us to this day. We can draw a straight line from the centuries of colonial exploitation to the social and economic inequalities of today. And we can recognize the racist tropes popularized to rationalize the inhumanity of the slave trade in the white supremacist hate that is resurgent today. It is incumbent on us all to fight slavery's legacy of racism. The most powerful weapon in our arsenal is education, the theme of this year's commemoration. By teaching the history of slavery, we hope to guard against humanity's most vicious impulses. By studying the assumptions and beliefs that allowed the practice to flourish for centuries, we unmask the racism of our own time. And by honoring the victims of slavery, we restore some measure of dignity to those who were so mercilessly stripped of it. Today and every day, let us stand united against racism and together build a world in which everyone, everywhere, can live lives of liberty, dignity, and human rights.
That was what UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in his message to mark Saturday's International Day to Remember the Victims and the Transatlantic Slave Trade.
This is a commentary on the Black World Media Network.
About 3 years ago this time, the country was in full pandemic mode. Then came panic mode. The full force of the coronavirus would quickly reveal itself along with all of our social.
This is a commentary on the Black World Media Network.
About 3 years ago this time, the country was in full pandemic mode. Then came panic mode. The full force of the coronavirus would quickly reveal itself along with all of our social and healthcare shortcomings. It did not help the nation's understanding of the pandemic that we had a sitting president with no belief in science. Today, official reports set COVID-19 deaths at over 1 million in the U.S. and over 104 million known cases. We had absolutely no comprehension of what was coming. None. So as not to re-traumatize my listeners, I will not recount all the ugly details that plagued us during lockdown, but suffice it to say, the emotional, social, economic, and political damage is still being experienced. This makes the total calculations a challenge. So I'll move to what we learned about ourselves as individuals and as a country. And what are we going to do about what we learned? We learned that when we don't get what we want when we want it, we are some cranky, impatient ingrates. Take, for example, the negative reaction of fans to NBA's cancellation of the season. We saw video footage of shoppers fighting over last package of toilet paper. We burned through first responders, hospital workers, teachers, and others because we refused to wear masks and get vaccinated, which only helped to skyrocket the number of COVID-19 cases and deaths. But we also learned that we can be kind, disciplined, and creative. We heard and saw countless incidents of humans bringing food, medicine, and joy to others, masked up and socially distanced. We found ways to use Zoom beyond the dreaded meetings for the job and set up musical concerts with people around the world. In times of isolation, we tapped into the unexplored realms of our own being and discovered new hobbies and even new careers. We learned how essential family, friends, and nature are to our overall well-being. We also knew that there were unaddressed racial disparities in healthcare prior to the pandemic. Black, brown, and poor communities were predisposed to the ravages of the virus. We saw the cracks in the healthcare system become gulfs as we witnessed accessibility, or I should say inaccessibility, to treatment. We saw who received the COVID test and vaccines first, and we followed where the resources were going to support families in other communities. We saw that companies readily put profits over the safety of their workers, often forcing them to work without adequate protections against the virus. Well, COVID-19 has faded from the headlines. The virus is still with us, but not like it was in 2021 or 2022. But there are still cases of deaths and active pandemic viruses. These mean something to somebody because these are somebody's loved ones. Heroic acts don't get reported any longer, nor does the irrepressible grief of a family who lost a loved one or loved ones to a finality that probably was preventable. With all that we've learned, I would love to see multiple symposiums on how we shape communities in a post-pandemic world. Bring all the stakeholders together to appreciate what we endured and how we can be better prepared when the next pandemic rolls around. And notice I didn't say if, I said when. I suspect that there are already some engaged in this kind of collaboration, but I fear that there's no real leadership that's going to come from our government or civic leaders. We'll continue to muddle along long after and until the next big thing comes along. I'm putting my faith in families who figured out a way to stay in touch with one another during a crisis. Some are already making financial provisions for future catastrophes, realizing that they could have been better prepared to deal with some of the different and additional expenses incurred. Families, they represent the hope for being ready to take on the next big thing with more insight, more tools, and more determination. Their unconditional love for family will be the impetus. This is Jamala Rogers, your Black feminist organizer. Just expressing myself. Thank you for listening.
Keep listening to the Black World Media Network and hear outstanding commentaries from some of the finer minds of the diaspora.
This is the Black World Media Network. The following is a rebroadcast of a commentary by imprisoned activist and journalist Mamia Abu-Jamal from In Prison Radio.
The wages of deregulation. A train races through the cool, wintry air, its wheels churning on iron rails until sparks burst into flames. And in the blink of an eye, a city in western Ohio becomes the latest scene of a railroad chemical disaster. For some of the trains contained vinyl chloride, which erupts, belching dark funnels of poisoned air into an early morning sky. And a local town called Palestine also erupts into fits of fear and fury. They roar, could this happen? How could it? One way is when politicians, eager to please voters, cut taxes. You know what happened? Deregulation. That other beloved cost cutter, right? Deregulation, that favorite target of so-called conservatives, also cut something else, safety. The disaster struck Palestine, Ohio, give residents heart palpitations and deep worry for generations, at least. How many headaches, cancers, or even unknown diseases may result from this massive chemical spill? No one really knows. Deregulation caused needless disasters. It's, as the saying goes, penny wise and pound foolish, and it may yet cause lives. With love, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
This is the Black World Media Network. This is the Black World Media Network. The following is a rebroadcast of a commentary by imprisoned activist and journalist Mamia Abu-Jamal from In Prison Radio.
The idiocies of original intent. For several decades, right-wing ideologues and lawyers have argued that the U.S. Constitution must only be interpreted according to what they call original intent. or according to how the founding fathers would have intended. But assuming this were so, how do we know what they intended? In short, we don't. But in some cases, we do. Thomas Jefferson only wrote one book during his lifetime entitled Notes on the State of Virginia. But Mr. Jefferson was a writer of letters, and there gave freely of his opinions. In his letter of 24th June, 1813, to John W. S., Jefferson wrote, "The earth belongs to the living, not to the dead." Thomas Paine was a talented writer whose pamphlets and books steered a nation into a war against a king. His book, The Rights of Man, published 1791, that no generation is bound by the words of the past. Paine wrote, "Every age and generation must be as free to act in itself in all cases as the ages and generations preceded it. The vanity and presumption of governing beyond the grave is the most ridiculous and insolent of all tyrannies. Man has no property in man, neither has any generation in the generations which are to follow." Thomas Paine, American revolutionary. As for Jefferson, guess who actually wrote most of the U.S. Constitution? None other than Thomas Jefferson himself. Idea of original intent didn't come from the founding fathers. It came from people in our lifetimes in a political project designed to turn the clock back and strip people of their rights. It is an idea based on idiocy. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
This is the Black World Media Network. That was a rebroadcast of a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
All right, folks, welcome back to Roland Martin Unfiltered here on the Black Star Network. We have seen the results of the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade. Now, let's be real clear. Anybody who believes that a woman has a right to choose should not be shocked by what has happened. The right has made perfectly clear what they were going to do. With that ruling, what did Clarence Thomas say? They wanted to go after birth control next. They want to go after everything. You now actually are seeing this. You're seeing states banning what some call the abortion pill or Plan B. You see them, some people want to go after contraception. You even had places like in Florida and other places where they wanted girls to turn in data on their menstrual cycles. Again, what these folks, these so-called family values folks, and remember, these are the same people when it comes to guns, they yell limited government, but on this issue, they want massive amounts of government. It was a huge issue in the 2022 election. Many people believe that it greatly helped Democrats and prevented a massive red wave from taking place across this country. The issue of a woman's right to choose is going to become a major issue in the 2024 election. I keep saying on this show, you cannot be waiting for 2024 before you begin to talk about the election. You must begin to lay the groundwork, the foundation today for next year's election, because it is going to take a lot. Because again, the right, the momentum is picking up. You see the actions that are taking place in various states as a result of that Supreme Court decision. Joining us right now to talk about this further is Alexis McGill Johnson. She is the president and CEO, Planned Parenthood Action Fund and Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Alexis, glad to have you here on Roland Martin Unfiltered. As I said there, this was a major part of the 2022 election. And I dare say it is going to be even bigger come the presidential election next year.
Absolutely. So, Roland, it's so good to be with you. Thank you so much for having me and taking on this conversation. You were absolutely right. In 22, I've been known to say abortion has actually saved our democracy. The fact that people were so fired up after the Constitution undid 50 years of almost 50 years of precedent, taking away our constitutional right to control our own bodies, and also understood it in the context of the rollback of our voting rights and our secure access to participating in democratic elections, changing the way we fundamentally teach history and education. All of these things, I think, intersected. And we know that when the opposition, tried to claim victory after Dobbs, they made it clear that Dobbs wasn't going to go far enough, because returning the decision back to the states, when there's no state in the union where these abortion bans are popular, they proclaimed that they were going to make 24 the litmus test for a national abortion ban. So we know they are going to continue to bring it up. They're going to double down, as you mentioned, on all of these crazy bills and bans that they are coming for. And, and I have to believe that the people are going to continue to show up to demonstrate that they are not going to stand for these encroachments upon our bodies for their power and control.
Obviously, you're not going to have the immediate effect of the Dobbs decision. And so from a strategic standpoint, how do you keep this top of mind for folks who next year may decide inflation, who may decide the economy, who may decide other issues are more important?
It's a great question. And I think this is a question that people were asking somewhat in the aftermath already after the Dobbs decision, when we saw inflation go up and when we saw the economy, respond to the inflation concerns. My response to that is that we are seeing the impact of the Dobbs decision. People are making incredible journeys, sometimes upwards of 400 miles one way, just to get access to medication, abortion, and having to, get back in time so that they can attend to the children they already have, the elders that are living with them and making the choices that they need to do. We are watching already in real time people who've intended pregnancies that are no longer viable, who are essentially miscarriage care, abortion care, and they are being told they need to get on planes in order to get that care. Those stories, I think, are forming a really important foundation that, will continue to be in people's minds as they go to elections. It's not just as if you take away a right and one day you stop thinking about it, right? It's happening in real time. Our job and our strategy is to continue to keep the issue salient so that these stories are still being told in the context of these bans and in the context of the broader story. One of the things that we saw is Gen Z, millennials, which we know is a generation that is the most diverse generation in our history, they saw the link not just to abortion rights, but to attack and assault on all of the other rights that they know are important.
I'm Goldie. This is my club. I run shit. Flattery will get you nowhere. I only get down with people I can trust.
When you really care about somebody, you go that extra mile for them.
This the ATL. Ain't nothing for free.
You know we know that.
Let's give them some action.
Put your money where your mouth is.
You know who I am.
Important to maintain free and authentic lives. They are packing this in. And so, the economy and inflation aren't always the things that are driving. It really is around what is the world that we want to see. And we know that just like 22, 24 is either going to be the end of our democracy or the opportunity for us to continue to realize the progress that we've made towards an inclusive democracy.
State Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, if Democrats regain control, they could have a 4-3 majority. That is huge because of that 1849 law in that state. We see Republicans have taken control of the North Carolina State Supreme Court. So obviously so much attention was focused on the U.S. Supreme Court. What are y'all doing? What are you looking at when it comes to these state courts? And now what we're seeing in the wake of the Dobbs decision?
Roland, I think what it does is it illustrates how important it is to understand where candidates sit on every level of every ballot. Oftentimes when you are in a election, the state Supreme Court line is all the way at the bottom or maybe on the back of your ballot sheet because you're always going in maybe for a federal race or your governor's race or your state senator's race or your mayoral race and your candidates. But those state Supreme Court lines, those elections have become even more important now that we are watching the reality of these states moving to ban or enact further restrictions that are not in alignment with where their state constitutions are or where the voters have said they would like to be. So in this state, Wisconsin, this Supreme Court, state Supreme Court race, there is a candidate, Janet Protasiewicz, who is, you know, an unabashed, you know, very pro-abortion rights, pro-reproductive rights Supreme Court justice. We have seen millions of dollars being poured into a race that normally would not yield that kind of energy. But because, as you said, there is an 1849 law on the books. 1849. We weren't even free, much less, you know, women free. And they are looking to roll us back to 1849 and continue to take our rights away in Wisconsin. So, you know, our energy, the resources that we are investing there look a lot like what you would see in a state or federal campaign. We are mobilizing people. We're engaging folks. We're making sure that they understand what's at stake, and that we can no longer just pay attention to what we would consider top of ballot races. We have to pay attention to what's happening in our state Supreme Courts, our DAs, our prosecutors, local sheriff. All of these races matter now even more because these decisions have been returned to the states.
Last year, I heard a lot of conversation about the impact of the Dobbs decision on Black women and Black communities. Yet when I was having conversations with a lot of Black-owned media outlets, I was not seeing the level of investment in on the ground, but also in Black-owned media when it came to advertising. I was seeing things happen other places. What about that? Because the reality is, we know that Black women are the largest Democratic voters. Black men are the second largest Democratic voters. And so if you want to see folks who are pro-choice in office, that's going to mean turning out the two largest blocks of Democratic voters. And so what are those discussions like about the importance of investing in those communities when it comes to messaging, when it comes to talking about this issue? And will there be a concerted effort specifically with Black-owned media for 2024 to reach the individuals who are not necessarily being reached by mainstream media?
Thank you for the question, Roland. I think it is critically important. You know, most of our media decisions have been made on the local level at Planned Parenthood. But I have a national initiative called the Black Health Equity Initiative, resources that we received from a large grant last year that I went to our board of community and said, I want to spend against what it will mean to turn Planned Parenthood into one of the best places for Black women and femmes to get access to health care. And that means we need to invest in campaigns. We need to invest in media. We need to invest in Black-owned media in ways that demonstrate our commitment to, you know, to the folks who are also trusted messengers in our community. You know, with respect to the broader community, look, I think these are conversations that we need to continue to have. There's always been a false choice, it seems, between turning out a base, which has been taken for granted for you know, decades, if not centuries, as well as, you know, or versus turning out the kind of bipartisan voters who, you know, who straddle the line and live in the suburbs. And I think that we can, what what we have seen consistently, and I think particularly in the midterms, is that people are crossing party lines, they're crossing generational lines, they're crossing racial and ethnic lines in ways that, because they understand how critical this issue is, not just for their personal autonomy, but also for our democracy in general. And we need to ensure that we are carrying that message to our communities and demonstrating our commitment through those resources.
Well, definitely love to hear more about that Black Women's Health Initiative, because obviously that's, you know, we target Black folks 365, 7 days a week on this show. Rebecca, your question.
Yes.
The best way to burn fat and get in shape, it's not keto, paleo, fasting, or vegan, and it's not super intense workout.
Thank you, Alexis. Over the years, I've worked with many candidates, and I've brought them in front of the Planned Parenthood board for endorsements for their campaigns. So my question for you is, especially knowing the role that Black women and Black femmes play in the fight for abortion rights, what is Planned Parenthood's plan for specifically and actively recruiting Black women running for office and supporting them financially? Because that second part is so important, but also the asking Black women, asking Black people, period, to run for office.
It is such a great question. So when, you know, we have a political action committee, our federal PAC, that endorses candidates on the federal level as the national organization. And I'm really proud of the record we have over the last few years, from the time I was chair until the time I stepped into this role, where the majority of candidates that we have endorsed have been people of color and women and Black women. And we've mobilized the resources that we have in our community towards these candidates and put up very specific links and, you know, done all the things to make sure that people have easy access. We're talking through and engaging, you know, all of the candidates, folks like Sherry Beasley in North Carolina, folks like, in Wisconsin, Mandela Barnes. I know he's not a Black woman, but people who are strong reproductive rights folks. I think it becomes even more important for us in this moment to identify in these open seats in these races to build from our bench. We have so many people, Planned Parenthood, I think because of who we are, because of folks who jump into a crisis at any time, are coming in and training and wanting to go out and seek higher office. So we're building that pipeline and also working with our partners across the movements to ensure that we have voices that look like us, that talk like us, that can speak to the complexity of what it means in the Black community to be a supporter of reproductive rights, how it connects to democracy, how it connects to our faith. All of those things are considerations that we are building and developing inside of our Action Fund work.
Robert, what is the plan for down ballot races? Because you spoke about federal races, but what about down ballot races? When I look at candidates in Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana and Texas, where abortion rights, you know, are dwindling.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that we work with our local affiliates to prioritize down ballot races and make sure that they have, the access that they need and the resources that they need to run. You know, I think in general, the importance of down ballot races is now just becoming to the fore for many folks. So, you know, some people come in every 2 years, every 4 years. And they check the top of the ballot. They never move down the ballot. And so our voter guides, continuing to send out through our, you know, communications to our Action Fund members, why it is so important to go all the way through. And I think particularly as we see in the Supreme Court race that, you know, the levers of power cannot shift unless we actually actively participate. So those are conversations that we're actively having with our affiliate partners on the Action Fund side, and our community partners and our state and reproductive justice partners.
Robert?
According to some recent polling, between 25 and 30% of Democratic voters consider themselves to be pro-life. The same poll said around 30% of African Americans generally see themselves as being pro-life, and particularly for African American men, nearly 40% or nearly 45% are pro-life. What is being done to help messaging so that they can talk, so that we can better talk to people who vote Democratic or part of the base but who may not be pro-life, to help them understand the issue in a way that isn't, you know, a direct attack, but actually bringing them over to a compromised position so you don't risk pushing people to a party where they might not agree with anything over the life issue, but where you can build coalitions and find places of compromise to help get the maximum turnout, to get candidates who will vote in your favor, but maybe disagree on certain issues?
That's a great question. I think, like, what we have seen consistently is that the majority of people in each state believe that they believe that Roe should have been the law of the land. And they believe that not because they personally supported abortion rights or they personally supported themselves having abortion, but because they understood that the decision needed to be made by the person who is pregnant, the, you know, and their partner and their pastor and all of the folks who legitimately need to be in the decision, and not the lawmaker down the street. When you look at these decisions being a function of the power and control of state lawmakers, as opposed to the power that we, you know, that's what bodily autonomy is. It's our ability to make the decisions about our own bodies and not have the interference of government intervention. That's why we saw a Kansas. That's why we saw a Kentucky. That's why we saw a Michigan in the midterms. You would not have had the varied states behaving in the ways they did in states that, seem to lean more Republican or at least be more purple, because people really bristled at the idea of the government making these decisions for them. And I think we need to continue to lean into that messaging and help people understand that doctors need to be making these decisions with patients, not lawmakers and lawyers.
It's time to retrieve all those files you thought you lost. This hard drive recovery converter from Zilke connects to any of your hard drives and instantly.
I got about 90 seconds to run your question.
My question is, how much work is being done about trying to shift the narrative from the way the right and the hard right talks about abortion and Planned Parenthood into making this more of like an education issue about like the fact that so many states that are pushing back against this, these ideas are like southern states that already have a terrible record with sex education? Has there been any movement on that as far as like making this an education issue outside of just the physical act and the procedure itself?
Of course, no. It's, not only do they have the most egregious rates on sex education and, you know, the states where they're only practicing or teaching abstinence in their schools, we also are seeing that many of these bans are the same states where they have the highest maternal mortality rates, the highest infant mortality rates, the lowest well-being rates for children. And so I think it is incumbent upon us to continue to ask these questions, because obviously they continue to hit Black women, more than three times in many of these states and cities, who are more likely to die from these causes. And so in many ways, whatever choice we make, we are more subject to die as a result of the healthcare system and our inability to make the decisions that are best for our bodies, because our doctors and the hospitals and the people who give information are subject to criminalization. And that's where I think we really need to expand the conversation.
All right. Alexis McGill-Johnson, we appreciate you joining us. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much, Roland, and everyone.
Brianna, what's on your radar?
Well, Fatia, I have what might be a hot take on the word woke. Hear me out. There is no one definition of wokeness. And the conversation that's emerged about whether there is a single definition of wokeness sort of misses the point. Now, of course, I'm alluding to our now viral rising interview with author Bethany Mandel, who co-authored a book about a war the left is allegedly waging on American children. In case you haven't seen the interview, which now has a Washington Post write-up, two Daily Beast write-ups, and a Huffington Post write-up, and it, which has been viewed over 7 million times on Twitter. In her interview, Mandel used the term woke repeatedly to describe the nature of this war on children. So in an effort to better understand her specific grievance, I asked her how she defined the word. Here's the now viral clip.
Consider themselves very liberal.
and probably fewer of them consider themselves to be woke. And so, you know, when we talk about traditional...
What does that mean to you? Would you mind defining woke? Because it's come up a couple times, and I just want to make sure we're on the same page.
So, I mean, woke is sort of the idea that... This is going to be one of those moments that goes viral. I mean, woke is something that's very hard to define, and we've spent an entire chapter defining it. It is sort of the understanding that we need to totally reimagine and redo society in order to create hierarchies of oppression. It's hard to explain in a 15-second soundbite.
You probably know Vistaprint for business cards, but did you know we also print that? And that, and that, and that too. Can't forget about...
Now, I want to be really clear. I did not intend for this to be a gotcha moment. I asked her to define woke because I wanted to know in good faith. And that's because I know that many people take that word to mean many different things, and I wanted to figure out whether I might agree with her on certain points, as I had done earlier in the interview. Alternatively, I wanted to be able to articulate why we differed on other aspects of her argument without devolving into the typical shouting matches that go, woke is bad, no, woke is good, oh no, you just don't know what woke really means. Say what you want about me, but I don't exactly have a reputation of being a woke scold. I spent a good part of my career as a leftist journalist critiquing what I believe to be certain overreaches of the left that, in my view, undermine important substantive fights for racial, gender, and economic equality. My very first two viral articles as a journalist were critiques of weaponized identity politics and of cultural appropriation discourse. In those articles, I questioned whether the gender and or race of politicians like Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris were in fact being used to insulate them from legitimate concerns about their records on criminal justice issues or, in Clinton's case, her choice of an anti-choice VP. I highlighted the perversity of Clinton using, dare I say, a kind of wokeness to excuse not regulating the banks more harshly in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Well, breaking up the banks and racism was a line she used to push back against Bernie's call for greater punishment for the bankers that destroyed the economy. And it's perverse for obvious reasons. Black people suffered disproportionately during the housing crisis, as more black wealth was rooted in real estate than was the case for other racial groups. Not only would breaking up the banks literally help black people, but nothing in Hillary's policy agenda was geared toward curing racism anyway. It was a rhetorical deflection that weaponized a sincere investment in traditional wokeness, e.g. racial equality, to do the exact opposite, protect the banks at the expense of people of color and working class people more broadly. In the cultural appropriation article, I questioned whether we should really be mad at folks like Kim Kardashian for wearing black hairstyles like cornrows, when in my view, the more serious concern is longstanding economic inequality that is racially distributed and which punishes black women for wearing the same hairstyles for which white women are celebrated. In other words, is the problem really that a white person did something like open a taco shop or cook Asian food? Or is it that, say, Latinos have more difficulty securing loans to open restaurants than white people and therefore aren't as able to profit from their own traditions as white people are? At any rate, I never described these left overreaches as woke because I grew up with the traditional meaning of the word, which was positive. Wokeness was defined as an awareness of historical and ongoing prejudices, mostly racial prejudices. But that doesn't mean I didn't identify moments where left social ideology, which at that point during the Obama years was ascendant, didn't seem to sometimes jump the shark in a way I worried would ultimately harm the interests of the left. So I came up with new terms like weaponized identity politics. Instead of just complaining about identity, which of course we all have and appreciate to certain degrees, and maybe I should have come up with something like weaponized wokeness, a toxic strategy liberals have been deploying for years, per the Hillary Clinton example. When conservatives complain about woke banks like SVB, they're half right. It's not that the bank failed because black people worked there. The bank failed because of deregulation, and I go into more depth about this in yesterday's Radar. But it is true that corporations have been using diversity initiatives to insulate themselves from legitimate criticisms about their business practices. like, for example, not having a risk officer for most of last year. Of course, it's possible to have boards that aren't all white or all straight and be attended to financial risks. But companies are playing a game of three-card Monty, hoping you look over there at the Pride Parade sponsorship so you don't notice their other more unsavory behaviors. Think Israel pink-washing fighter planes that drop bombs on Arabs of all sexual preferences, or McDonald's introducing paper straws that turn out to be non-recyclable. Being woke, the good kind of woke, is sometimes profitable, at least in the current moment. So companies do want to appear woke, but no, they don't actually want to spend money on creating real economic equality. That would eat at their bottom line. So they co-opted wokeness, equality and justice movements, to claim unearned public goodwill. And this is something I criticize regularly, along with a certain kind of sensitivity around speech and language as violence rhetoric that can do too often shut down meaningful conversations that help each other understand each other as a community and form bonds that could help us go after the real enemy, the elites who hope to keep us in line by performing wokeness or anti-wokeness instead of paying fair wages, cleaning up the pollution that leaks into our communities, like what's happening in East Palestine, and sending our kids to war. So when Bethany said she was worried about wokeness affecting young children, I genuinely wanted to know what she meant. Now, it's become clear as she answered my question that she might not have been used to answering that kind of question. And I understand why. Most of us are in ideological silos. And when we speak predominantly to people within our own bubbles, we can get away with being kind of imprecise. Everyone in our own audience knows what we mean and can project their own frustrations and their own definitions on these kinds of words. Woke is perfect for exactly that reason. It gives a lot of cultural cachet to a lot of fragmented different ideas about what's wrong in the world. I mean, we all have something that we're mad at in these modern times, and I have even found myself reaching for the word woke as an easy catch-all to describe behavior by liberals that I disagree with. Say, liberals who dismissed Matt Taibbi's reporting on the Twitter files on the basis that he's a, quote, white man, instead of engaging substantively with what they do or do not appreciate about his work. But when pressed for specifics, it became clear, at least from my subjective view, that there wasn't much I agreed with respect to Mandel's argument about the left's war on children. The example that she offered when pressed was of a friend's 5-year-old child who came home from a birthday party saying she liked girls, and that her teacher responded, "That's okay." You can read the tweet for yourself here on the screen, and there's nothing in that tweet or in the rest of the thread that indicates that the child meant that she liked girls romantically. Kids, of course, often find members of the opposite sex distasteful at that age, saying they have cooties and are gross. And as I said to Bethany on the show, it seems to me that if anyone's sexualizing children, it was her friend who presumed the girl meant that she wanted to have a romantic relationship with other girls. Moreover, "that's okay" is probably the most neutral way a person can respond to a child in that situation. Would someone prefer a teacher tell a kid that it's wrong to like girls? Is telling a kid it's wrong to like girls not a kind of indoctrination that cuts in the opposite direction? See, so much of this discourse ignores that teachers and parents are dealing with really tough choices. Child rearing is deeply personal, but much of a child's life is spent away from parents at school. There are bound to be values gaps between parents and teachers cutting in both directions. My grandfather didn't love the indoctrination of my mom being forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance in the years after the McCarthy era and the intelligence agency's attacks on Black equality movements at the time. Maybe someone else would prefer to pass on some religious teaching that condemns homosexuality, for instance. But I'd argue it's not the school's role to parrot my grandfather's militancy any more than it is for a teacher to project homophobia on a 5-year-old who probably just thinks that boys are gross because she's 5. Instead of engaging in our communities, trying to find neutral ground, and celebrating teachers like the one in Mandel's example who managed to give a non-committal, non-sexual, non-judgmental affirmation to a child, some of us are holding folks like that up as literal groomers. Now, I might agree with Mandel that some people engage in hierarchies of oppression or use their historically discriminated against status to bully others, say, in classroom contexts, into submitting to their worldview. Of course that happens sometimes. I've seen it. I might agree that it's wrong to lash out at people who make good faith mistakes as they try to wrestle with new social norms like pronouns and dead names, but who are genuinely trying to do the right thing and be polite and courteous to others. Left-leaning author Sam Adler-Bell, in fact, wrote a really compelling piece in New York Magazine last year, which I covered on my podcast, Bad Faith. In it, he defined the new wokeness, not the old version, but this kind of new sensibility of something going off the rails, as, quote, the invocation of unintuitive and morally burdensome political norms and ideas in a manner which suggests they are self-evident. And I think that that definition is important. I agree with that framing in particular, so far as it criticizes not traditional wokeness, but the idea that these new norms are supposed to be self-evident, when they're not. They're new. And that those of us who stumble to adapt to them should be subject to ridicule or, dare I say, cancellation when you err in good faith. Think, for example, the Stanford banned words list that condemned the use of the term grandfathered in. Is that something that most people are aware of and that they should get a tongue lashing for continuing to use in conversation? I think most of us agree, no. So the reason why it was important for Sam to define a version of wokeness before he critiqued it is the same reason I urged Bethany to define it. Because it can mean so many things to so many people, a failure to define the word woke serves to divide us and obscure the extent to which most of us agree about some basic things. One, it's good to live in a pluralistic society, but it can be challenging. We want to protect our freedoms without infringing on others. And when we butt heads, when we do infringe, we want to treat each other with compassion and understanding. That means Bethany homeschooling her children and having the right to do so. It also means opposing state efforts to ban the rights of other parents to allow their children to access gender-affirming care if they, in consultation with their doctors, believe that's the right course of action. It means trying to respect people when they tell you how they identify, or alternatively, accepting that a decision not to respect other people's identity means you might not be liked very much, and that's okay. You know, if your name is Bob and I insist on calling you Cheryl, I don't get to claim to be canceled when you don't want to be around me or work with me. That's just common decency. My problem with so much of this wokeness discourse, and this was also true of cancel culture discourse and CRT discourse, by the way, is that when we get to specific cases, most of us agree on a lot. Mandel cited a statistic that only 7% of people identify as woke, but in fact, a recent study in The Hill showed that most people view it as a positive term. Most Americans oppose things like book banning, even if you put the word woke in front of books, and that includes books that are banned in the interest of wokeness, like the Roald Dahl stories that are being edited to exclude words like fat or ugly. Liberals agree that that was an overreach. Whoopi Goldberg agreed. So what are we actually arguing about exactly? Look, I don't want to play dumb here. I'm sure there is a sincere disagreement about whether, say, a book affirming the validity of parents who are exotic dancers is appropriate for school-aged children. That was another example that Bethany brought up in our interview. And school boards can decide whether or not they want to keep a book like that in a school library. But advocates like Bethany seem to sometimes be arguing that those books shouldn't exist at all, that they should be censored altogether, not even published. But the reality of life is that some exotic dancers have children, some sex workers have children, and those jobs are real jobs that put food on their family's table. And those parents have every right to seek out or even write literature that helps them explain their reality to their children. Look, some parents are obese, some parents smoke, some parents only see their kids once a month, some parents engage in all kinds of behaviors that I might not choose for my hypothetical children. But I think it would be deeply authoritarian and presumptuous of me to tell other parents that they can't access books that help them explain their life and their reality to their children. Wokeness is hard to define for the same reason that what is a woman is a hard question to answer pithily. It's because different people have different definitions of the word. It's that simple. It isn't a gotcha, and it shouldn't be treated as such. But we also should all be able to identify specifically what we're really mad at, so our society doesn't devolve into all of us being mad at each other while the world burns.
Hi, I'm Jenny, one of the Silver Sneakers Master Trainers, and I know getting and staying
So, Batia, I felt, you know, some kind of way about the pile-on. I think that some people really missed the point of an exchange like that, which is just to say it's actually difficult to define these words because we all have different things in mind. And I would love us just to be more specific about what we talk about so we don't end up in these interminable debates about what people really mean when they say something.
Right. So I should start by saying Bethany is a dear friend of mine. She obviously knows what the word woke means. She tweeted her definition later in the day, and she was angry about a lot of the most important things, I think, in terms of children, at least throughout the COVID period, one of the few early voices who understood how difficult that was going to be for kids. And anybody laughing at her having that brain freeze obviously does not spend a lot of time going on TV and has not written a book, because honestly, Brianna, like, there but for the grace of God go I, right? All of us kind of.
I have been there.
You do that a lot, had that.
I've had my day on the internet for sure.
Exactly. So what I want to do is sort of make the case for why, very briefly, why I think that using the word woke actually might have a benefit that I think you might actually even agree with. You know, first of all, the wokes are obviously the people who, from the left, who hate a hard time for being so eloquent about the dangers of, you know, so my definition of wokeness, right, superimposing a racial binary onto a power binary in a way that suggests that, you know, Don Lemon is a victim and the residents of East Palestine are oppressors, right? You know, you are very eloquent in calling that out. And the people who hate you for doing it, that is the people that, you know, I think it's important to have a terminology that allows us to critique that, but a terminology, crucially, that is available to people who don't have the luxury that we do of sitting around and talking about what to call things all day. You know, I'm working on a book about the working class, which means I talk to a lot of working class Americans every week, a lot of people of color, who use the word woke because it came to represent something that bothers them about what their children are being taught in school. Excuse me. And so I think a little bit that there is a class component to saying, look, we need to not use this word that has come to stand in for something that we can all agree is happening in a useful way, to critique it. Because, you know, we need a word that is accessible, is I guess what I would say. It doesn't have to be woke. But to me, giving people who don't have the luxury of sitting around all day and thinking about what to call things a vocabulary to describe something that they are seeing and noticing and is bothering them and upsetting them, and as you point out, from a class point of view, from an economic point of view, is impacting them deeply, right? As it takes over the Democratic Party, as it sidelines more progressive ideas, I think that would be my case for the word. So what do you make of that, Brianna?
My concern is that, one, woke has not organically had the shift in meaning. It is people like Christopher Rufo who very purposefully changed the meaning of that word and used words like CRT, introduced new words and concepts like CRT that weren't really commonly known, because they understand that they can capitalize on sincerely held, often economically driven concerns, and take it from the realm of do something about my economic status to this is actually a cultural problem, and then have people in power, have elites that have control, status, and money not have to be responsible to the underlying economic concern, because they can superficially appear to be going after it by going after something as abstract as wokeism. So I would argue that leaning into those kind of words and help people who are elites and powerful avoid their fundamental responsibilities. It's Hillary Clinton saying, I'm going to do wokeness. We're going to do racial identity politics. We're breaking up the banks, cure racism, right, instead of breaking up the banks. And on the other side, it's Ron DeSantis saying, it's a woke company. It's woke Disney. There are woke issues going on here, instead of breaking it down the issues. Are there labor issues going on at Disney? Do the workers there get enough money? Are you erasing the reality of low-income workers in Disney World by calling them woke? Does the fact that they might have political beliefs, cultural beliefs that are different from yours, make them fundamentally not your ally in a struggle for good pay and labor protections? And so, I got to just push back against that. The problem in East Palestine isn't wokeness. It's that there are lobbyists who spend millions of dollars rolling back safety regulations or preventing safety regulations from being in place, which might have prevented a crisis like this happening in the first place. And it's very difficult for me to understand how words like woke and some of these other cultural terms do anything other than get people farther away from having an acknowledgement that they have a class identity and class solidarity to each other that, if they're able to access, can help them actually change the economic reality in this country.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Where am I?
You're on the radio. What an opportunity to be valuable to the people who should mean a lot to you. I'm talking about all your secret friends over the airwaves. You're on the radio too.
You on the radio with WRCT Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Where am I?
You're on the radio. You're on the radio. What an opportunity to be valuable to the people who should mean a lot to you. I'm talking about all your secret friends over the airwaves. You're on the radio too.
You are on the radio with WRCT Pittsburgh.
Where am I?
You're on the radio. You're on the radio. What an opportunity to be valuable to the people who should mean a lot to you. I'm talking about all your secret friends over the airwaves. You're on the radio.
You are on the radio with WRCT Pittsburgh.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Where am I?
You're on the radio. You're on the radio. What an opportunity to be valuable to the people who should mean a lot to you. I'm talking about all your secret friends over the airwaves. You're on the radio too.
You are on the radio with WRCT Pittsburgh.
Where am I?
You're on the radio. You're on the radio. What an opportunity to be valuable to the people who should mean a lot to you. I'm talking about all your secret friends over the airwaves. You're on the radio.
You are on the radio with WRCT Pittsburgh.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Where am I?